What's your cut?
Half.
Half the bounty to guide? Seems steep.
No. Half of the blurg you helped capture.
The blurg?
Ah, blurg!
You can keep them both.
No, you'll need one. To ride. The way is impossible to pass without a blurg mount.
Ugh, blurg.
I don't know how to ride blurg.
I have spoken.
This is the Extra Hot Crate Podcast, episode 276 for the week of November 11th, 2019. I am Power Droid Escort David T. Cole, and I'm here with Womp Rat Sarah D. Bunting.
Ow.
Sassy Strill Tara Ariano.
This is what I thought blurgs were called.
Wookie Cop Adam Grossworth.
It's my first day on the beat. What could go wrong?
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Joining us this week is the one, the only, the creator of the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone, Mr. Adam Grossworth. Welcome, Adam.
Woo!
Adam.
Hello. Yay!
Today we are talking about the first Star Wars live-action TV series courtesy of Disney Plus, The Mandalorian. Not the midichlorian, not Man-and-DeLorean, the... No. What was it, Tara?
Michael Mann and John DeLorean opening a law firm called Mandalorian.
Would watch.
This is, in fact, a watershed moment, literally a watershed moment in the Star Wars universe, because if nothing else, now we know that space toilets are canon. let's throw it to Adam for some overall quick views, and then we'll get into the nitty gritty of it, because there's quite a bit of that. Adam, what did you think of The Mandalorian episode one?
All right, so I'm just gonna lay it all out. I'm wearing Star Wars pajamas right now. Aww. And on my desk in front of me are toys of Muppets as Star Wars characters that I bought at Disney World. So I'm not gonna pretend that I'm too good for any of this. But I wasn't super into it. I mean, I'll definitely keep watching it at least a little longer. But like, I'm of a Star Wars vintage, and I think you are too, Dave, where like I had movies and toys, and like there were novels and there were comic books, but they were pretty fringy.
Yeah.
And the universe has expanded a lot. And part of me liked that they just kind of dropped us into this, but I also kind of didn't know what was going on and also didn't care. And I feel like they do a lot of shorthand, and this has expanded to the movies too, where it's like, look, a helmet. Look, a species. Like, it doesn't actually mean anything. And we were expected to just sort of be like, oh, I recognize that thing, but I didn't necessarily.
I kind of felt like there was a lot of fan service detail, but I didn't get the impression that there was like big informational plot elements that you needed to know from the movies in order to like get the general flow of this.
Well, I mean, I don't know what a Mandalorian is, for starters.
I do, because I just know these things through osmosis.
I mean, I looked it up. I mean, I could tell you now, but...
But at this point in time, I think you just need to know they're space Vikings.
Right. That's fair.
That, I think, is the starting point, but I don't think you're supposed to know all the lore behind it, because the lore isn't that interesting, frankly.
That's fair.
But you just felt lost.
I felt bored more than lost. I just thought it was kind of slow. And like, there's a thing they establish really early. There's like a line of exposition that's like, oh, you Mandalorians, is it true you never take your helmets off? And yes, it is. But like, that's hard. Like, I mean, he's doing really good work to Mark Blankenship it up. He's doing really good mask work. But like, that's tough to like have your lead in that helmet forever.
Especially given who it is.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Like, where are the jeans in space?
Thank you.
I was going to say, there's no mask on his ass.
Yeah, his butt looks good. Acknowledged. But I'd like to see his face, too.
We are talking about Pedro Pascal, Tara's butt buddy.
Before I looked it up, I thought it was Oliphant, because the, whatever, Mandalorian vocoder makes him sound like Oliphant. Mm-hmm. And then when I found out who it actually was, I was like, ooh, Tara Duofecta.
Yeah, you would know it was Timothy Oliphant, because he walks so weird. And when if they put him in all of that like armor as well, he would probably walk even weirder. He's got a real tight ass...
Yeah, he does have that weird, like, vertical loft, you're right.
Yeah. What did you think, Sarah?
I did feel like you know, I watched the prequels, and then that's sort of where I left it with this franchise. Like, I'm not against it, but I just feel like they're now twice as many like franchise properties as I can manage. So it was like, well, I'm gonna have to be dropped in to the middle of this regardless, because I have no like after what's his name like crawling in the lava and being like, a Sith only deals in absolutes. I was like, all right, I think I'm done with this. So I had no grounding between that and this. Right. And this was enjoyable. I was sad that the battle droid died. Spoiler, I guess, because it was cool and made me laugh. The teeny tiny infant Yoda was fucking adorable. I'm not made of stone. But I'm also not going to keep, I'm not going to keep watching it, because I just felt like there was really a lot of look at me directing shit that was happening, like establishing shots of CGI spaceships and mountains. Like, it just needed to be a little more, it needed to move faster. And so, like Adam, I was not lost any more than anyone else, I don't think, but I was also not compelled all that much. Like, it was enjoyable. I'm not angry that I watched it, but I'm done.
And that's kind of what I'm talking about with, like, little baby Yoda, who, yes, adorable, which, like, in the properties I've seen, and, like, I've skipped most of Clone Wars, and, you know, I don't know, but, like, we've only seen, like, one of whatever Yoda is. Presumably there's more of him, right? Like, Yoda had parents, like, you know, and so, like, there's all this weight given to just seeing this creature because Yoda exists, right? And it's sort of like if in El Camino there was, like, some white dude and it was like, look, a human, he must be Walter White's long lost son, which is not how things work, but I'm sure it is going to be how it works. It was just like a weird, I don't know, it was like all this weight on that moment. And I guess, spoiler, it's like the last beat of the episode, sorry. It actually really annoyed me, because I was like, well, what does it mean? But it was like so fraught with everything, just because we're bringing all this Star Wars knowledge. But we are bringing all the Star Wars knowledge. I mean, like I said, I'm not better than this. Like, I am that guy. Like, but I don't know. It just felt funny to me. But I also want to keep watching, because I want to know who that adorable baby is. So, like, they got me, I guess.
Well, and also, what, like, where does it go from here? Is it like exactly. Mr. Mom DeLorean?
Right.
Where he just, like, puts it in a bunting and is like, okay, and now, you know, off we go looking for the actual creature on who I have a bounty. Like, there were a lot of things in this that could have been bunt nip, like finding out it was Javier Pena. That's not the worst. Werner Herzog, definitely not the worst. Please have him handle all of my intergalactic negotiations. Of course, I love him. But this just felt like just doing it for the sake of doing it. And I guess that's fine. But I don't think it's for me. And I don't think my opinion should necessarily drive anyone to or away from.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear you say you haven't watched the newest Star Wars movies, Sarah.
No, I haven't.
Oh, they're so good. Carrie Fisher's in them, so they're automatically good.
Oh, okay. I mean, I'm not against them if, you know, when they show up on whatever, yeah, like, well, premium cable,
they're on
I will
Disney
watch
Plus.
Them.
I was going to say, you can watch them for your free week.
Yeah, maybe I'll do that.
Yeah.
All right, Dave, what was it like for you watching the show? Because I know from living with you that you're on, like, r/Star Wars all the time. So you knew a lot about this thing going into it. Did it meet your expectations and hopes?
I did enjoy it. I just want to speak to what Adam and Sarah were saying, where mm-hmm. I kind of felt like this is supposed to be a little bit different from everything we've seen before, insofar that it is just this contained story in the same universe as Star Wars takes place. Yes, there's familiar elements and familiar designs and stuff like that, but we're not supposed to be establishing ties in our wall of crazy with the red, you know, ribbons and all that kind
right.
of stuff. Like,
right.
I think this is purposefully new IP. And yeah, the guy looks like Boba Fett from Star Wars, but he's not. Like, Boba Fett wasn't even, like, Boba Fett just grabbed the armor in the lore. Like, he wasn't even a Mandalorian. He was just some dude that liked that stuff. So he went and looked the look, right? So I feel like this story is kind of what Star Wars needs, frankly. I think they need to, like, kind of just get away from the Skywalker stuff. Obviously they are. They're ending it this year with the last movie, but I feel like they wanted to create a Star Wars like Western, and this sets up that. And I felt like it did it pretty well. I didn't feel lost or not engaged because, you know, there was a mix of new and old. I mean, that's how they're going to do it. The Yoda thing didn't bother me. There was one other Yoda so far in the Star Wars universe. There's two that we know of. There's Yoda and Yaddle. That's right, Yaddle. She was in Phantom Menace. She's another one of the Jedis.
Oh, yeah. That feels like some holiday special shit, though.
kind of was.
Which got a shout out.
It did.
I appreciated the Life Day reference.
Yeah, there was a Life Day. Horatio Sands as the blue dude talking about Life Day. I thought that they did a pretty good job just setting up a different corner of the universe. And it's interesting, you know, as a Star Wars fan to see where the universe is a little bit after the Empire actually falls and Return of the Jedi, and things are just sort of messy now, you know, like at the end of Jedi, all it was just scenes of celebration across the universe. But now this is the actual reality where X commanders are now warlords and hanging on to whatever they can. And it's kind of a little dirtier, a little grittier. And I just kind of enjoy it. And the Mandalorian aspect is going to be interesting to see how they sort of fold in what crazy Star Wars fans know about that whole world into what's going on in the show, because it's not that important. But also you get the feeling that they're building up to something, you know, because the Mandalorian is part of this diaspora of his people that just sort of live here and there after, you know, some terrible event has happened. But also, like, he goes into this room and every time he gets a little piece of steel, he seems to get like a video game store upgrades. Right. Like, uh-huh. Weird little things like that. I enjoyed it. I think it was fun. Right. I felt actually it was short, which it was. It was actually less than 40 minutes.
Yeah, it was a good 4 minutes of credits. Yeah.
So I was sort of surprised, as short as it was. I don't mind, you know, like I'd rather them tell the story they need to tell in the time it takes to tell it, rather than be like, I was expecting an hour of stuff.
Yeah.
As sort of like somebody who loves Star Wars, but is also interested in the periphery, you know, what's going on here and there of it, I felt pretty fulfilling. And for as short as that episode was, they crammed in quite a bit, even though, as Adam was saying, a lot of it was a little exposition-y, you know, setting expectations like that math ain't coming off anytime soon. Tara, you just watched it like literally an hour ago. What do you think?
I don't disagree with Sarah and Adam. Obviously, I will keep watching it because I don't want to sleep on the lawn. But just kidding. I know you wouldn't care if I watched it or not. In fact,
you actually have to sleep in the street.
Right. Dave famously will not let me go to his first viewings of Star Wars movies with him in case I act up or something. Although he relaxed that now that we're in Alamo land.
Who's that? What happened to his hand?
What did she say when I said, who's that? but I also wasn't clear of like, oh, is that there was a difference between like Mandalorian is an order or a tribe or something and Bounty Hunter is separate. Like, I didn't understand what the Venn diagram was between them, but although calling it the Mandalorian, either. I guess I should have probably figured that out. Yeah, I like Pedro Pascal. I will be sad if we never get his helmet off. I kind of assumed it would come off before the end of the first episode, so that was a bit of a bummer. Werner Herzog was good, but I also wasn't totally clear. I mean, until Dave said this is after Return of the Jedi, that wasn't clear to me either. Like, at what point in the story this one takes place.
Well, there's a reference when they're talking about money. That
I got based on the currency. Yeah.
Well, no, yes, I know that they said, you know, the Empire is over, but whatever.
How much time was passed? I see what you're saying. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm interested to learn more about this guild because it sounds like there's a labor story here where, you know, there's not a lot of class solidarity between these, but I'm just joking. I also like the IG unit. He was pretty badass when he had his two arms up shooting like he's, you know, in a Mexican standoff. That was great. I have a feeling that unit will be back, or that voice or spirit will be in another droid, you know, because I assume they're all kind of the same. And my only other note was the lip puppetry on the whiskers guy that I guess was voiced by Nick Nolte was very bad. Like, it feels like that technology should have advanced further because it was not in sync at all, and very distracting. But, you know, it was enticing enough for me to want to see where it's going. And it, you know, looks very handsome and expensive. And the effects other than the lips were good, I thought.
The one thing I appreciated about this series that has actually sort of not made me angry, but disappointed in recent stuff is that in the movies that there was a time in the Star Wars timeline when Jedi stopped existing, right? And like Obi-Wan right. and Yoda are the only ones left. And in the prequels, like, you know, there's a thing, it's like Order 66 and they go and they kill all the Jedis. But then like every like thing that's not the movies, it's like, yeah, Order 66, Obi-Wan and Yoda only survived that. And then there's one guy, right? And then and Rebels was like that. Rebels had two. There's like every video game based on Star Wars, which are all canon now. There's actually one coming out this week. And it's like, and this Jedi survived the thing. And it's sort of like, it's sort of just like every time they do that, it dilutes what they have already done. So I'm like just happy to have a major Star Wars project that doesn't revolve around yet another Jedi who was hiding out for 30 years and just like, you know, right. opens the door. He's got a big, long, crazy beard. It's like, well, time to be a Jedi again. So like that didn't happen. And I'm happy for that because enough of that. Like, ugh. The other thing I thought is nice to have a major property, the action property again, where you can totally tell the geography of all the fight scenes and all the battle scenes again, as opposed to just cutting it very quickly to make it seem frenetic. Like the thoroughfare fight at the end, the shootout, that was something like I could have seen when I went to Fantasy Island, you know, and on every hour it's the Wild West shootout on the main thoroughfare and you're shooting the guy on top of the building, you're shooting the guy coming out of the door. Like it was fun like that. And you could tell what was going on as opposed to like, you know, Bourne Identity-ing the whole thing. It's interesting because the first episode was actually directed by the guy that sort of has been doing all the animation stuff for the past few years. He was sort of like under George Lucas's wing before he sold the whole company. And I guess this is his transition to actual stuff. But that guy has done like so much damage, in my opinion, to like the purity of like Star Wars concepts. Like he introduced this sort of like time travel-y thing in Rebels, which was like, I hate that. You know, my law about science fiction, no time travel, no shape-shifting, you know, and all these things have been introduced in Star Wars here and there, and it bugs the hell out of me. But I thought he did an okay job, a little laggy, but overall, I thought he did a pretty good job. And I also liked all the little stuff. Like, if you're into Star Wars, you know, you enjoyed the Return of the Jedi, Jabba the Hutt door knocker thing coming out and talking to him. You know, we had Jawas, we had Life Day, we had the roasted lizard monkey on a stick.
I really enjoyed the Salacious Crumb cameo. Yeah. I made a little noise when that happened.
I guess the only other nitpick I had is I wasn't really sure what to make of the music because it's so different.
It was intrusive. I had a note about that.
I felt the same way. Like at some points, it was a bit much. And there's this one bit of music, if you actually go back and watch this again, it's when they're riding the blurgs and they're going to the encampment. There's like music that sounds like it's right out of like Rocky. It is so weird. Like it, there's just beats of it that are like, dun, 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 dun. Like it sounds like Rocky. And I was like, what the
heck? And Apollo isn't even in the scene.
Exactly.
I'm glad they did that though, instead of doing like bad, like the Clone Wars music, which is like bad synthy, like John Williams samples. I'd rather they just do their own thing than...
I didn't mind the tone that they were going for because it was sort of drum beaty tribal Winwoods they were using that had a very certain feel. But as Sarah said, like it was sometimes in the wrong place and then sometimes it was louder than it should have been. And it was, as she says, intrusive.
Yeah. Dave, you made a strong case to me, at least, to keep watching it, which I was going to do anyway. But because I did really like Rogue One, and I think the idea of like a standalone story. And the thing I also really like about the new movies is just like the world building of it, of like, you know, where are we now? X number of years after everything blew up. And I would have liked more processy stuff in this.
Yeah.
Of just establishing, you know, where and when we are in relation to the world we already know. And so I'm hoping we'll get more of that as we go along, because I'm into that.
And that brings up like one of my major, like, if I could go back in time and convince Lucasfilm not to do something they did, go back and just have all your properties, have the fucking scroll at the beginning, because there's always exposition that you can get out of the way. Like, Rogue One needed that scroll like nobody's business. Like, if you had that scroll, that like first 10 minutes where you're bopping between 10,000 planets, which was such a whiplash mess, you could have like avoided all of that. And the same with this. I feel like if you had just like two paragraphs on the Mandalorians, this takes place 5 years after the destruction of the second Death Star, like, it would have been, oh, okay, I know where I am. And there's no, like, there's no harm in that. It's part of the Star Wars shtick. You know, nobody's going to say it's lazy for Star Wars, because it's not, and that's what they do. Like, these are all born out of serialized matinee cliffhanger shows. So go ahead, go nuts, have that kind of stuff. You know, part of the Star Wars DNA, and they should have done that. Rant over. It's time to go around the dial, and today we're going to start with Adam, because he's got some more Disney Plus stuff.
So, the other big original series dropping on Disney Plus today is High School Musical, The Series. They say representation matters. Dave, please play the clip.
Do you even know the plot of High School Musical?
Of course! It's about Zac Efron dancing with a basketball.
Wrong. It's about the character Troy having to choose between being true to his friend Chad or following his heart with Gabriella.
Why do you know so much about High School Musical?
They played on a loop in my allergist office.
My, at the time, 9 or 10 year old niece once asked me why I know so much about High School Musical in that exact tone, so I feel very seen. High School Musical, the musical, the series, is a mockumentary about the high school where the High School Musical Disney Channel movies were shot, putting on a production of the stage adaptation of High School Musical. If that sounds like a feedback loop, it's because it is. Disney has spent 10 years indoctrinating a generation and me in this stuff. And now they're like, look, nostalgia. And also, we're cool enough to make fun of it. If you understand why "you read for Kelsey" is a gasp-worthy line, then this show might be for you. So if you're someone who thinks that Disney is crushing originality and destroying our culture, I have absolutely no argument for you. But I liked it. It's not going to fill the smash-sized hole in my heart, but there was a moment when they did the trope of an audition becoming a fully designed fantasy where it might have for a second. It's casually queer in a way that Glee wishes it could have been. Maybe I'm just old and out of touch and this is how Gen Z is, but it still feels like a bit of a radical fantasy to me, especially because the character who was clearly coded as gay in the movie suddenly wound up with a girl in the end of the third one. And this is still Disney. It's still essentially made for kids, and it's still set in Utah. No offense to Utah, but, you know.
I didn't know that.
No offense to Utah, but, you know.
I mean, I don't think the original movies are set in Utah, but it was shot in a high school in Utah, so it is now set in Utah. So I don't want to necessarily give a giant corporation a pat on the back just for not being assholes, but Disney has such a rep for being super protective of its brand that I do enjoy when they have a sense of humor about themselves and have some fun. If you can't acknowledge that a basketball musical number is both technically impressive and fundamentally silly, then I think you're doing it wrong. So I will watch every episode of this. I will not learn a single character's name, and I will forget that it happened the second it's over, but I think it's fun.
How many colons are in that title? Just
two. High School Musical, the musical, the series. Mm-hmm. I think it should be High School Musical, the series. Like, if you're going to do it, or Disney's High School Musical, the musical, the series. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
I think every season they should, like, add something to the title.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's already been renewed, and they've said that the second season will not be them doing High School Musical 2. It will be them doing something else. So that'll be... Mm. Who knows? Their original songs, I don't know. It's cute. It's made for children, but whatever. It's cute.
Well, and I asked you this when I saw you this week, but you can say for our listeners as well that in terms of where it lies in the on the spectrum of, you know, Disney sitcoms, live action sitcoms for tweens, you said this is superior to like A Suite Life with Jack.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert. But I've, you know, from seeing them in the background when being around other people's children. You know, and I think it's right because this is made for kids who grew up on High School Musical, right? So I think it's pretty aimed at teenagers as opposed to tweens.
Right.
You know, and there's definitely like a lot of winking involved. I think it's fun. It's, you know, I'm in my 40s. It's I'm not the target audience, but in a little bit, in some way I am. I mean, it's definitely, you know, there's a sheen of irony on it that I think they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Encore is an actual reality show that reunites the cast of actual High School Musicals to perform their shows again 10 to 20 years later with the help of professional directors and choreographers and their drama teachers who are just there for some reason. This very strangely aired one episode on regular ABC 2 years ago and then disappeared with no explanation. And there are some clues that these episodes were shot a while ago, so I suspect that they're just burning them off, which is too bad because I am, unsurprisingly, extremely charmed by this show. It has a sort of Great British Bake Off vibe in that the stakes are very low and everyone seems to genuinely like each other. It's just a fun thing they're doing with a bit of restoring confidence and reliving past glory. There's some filler, but also a decent amount of process stuff. The original Broadway Belle works with the cast in the Beauty and the Beast episode, which will be on next week, and that is delightful. Of the three episodes I've seen, including the one from 2 years ago, as far as I remember, it seems to work best when they're 20 years out of high school, not 10, and when none of them have anything to do with the entertainment industry anymore. It's just more interesting. And there's something really ridiculous about watching a 40-year-old play Annie and fully commit. And if you're not charmed by her commitment, then you are dead inside. And speaking of dead inside, also dropping today is The Story of Imagineering, which is a documentary about the history of Disney parks. And it's kind of interesting if you're a Disney parks nerd, but also probably nothing you don't already know if you're a Disney parks nerd. And it is definitely 100% propaganda. The first episode ends with the death of Walt Disney, so I'm hoping it gets a little less gross going forward because the history is pretty interesting. But the first episode is like superhero worshipy and made me kind of uncomfortable.
So there's no episode about people barfing in the mascot costumes in the park? Is that what you're saying?
Not yet.
No Nazi Ubermen are our superiors episode?
No, it's really like, let's talk about how great Walt Disney was.
Right.
And, you know, what I'm hoping it will be is like really nerdy behind the scenes stuff, but it's not that yet. And I suspect it won't be. It's just like, this great man built this great theme park, and I'm like, oh, okay. Like, I'm a fan, but just not that interesting.
Yeah. I think I think it was American Masters that had a two-parter on him a few years ago, and that will be on the PBS app. And if you want a slightly less hagiographic take on his ascent and, you know, ascent, that also includes the frozen head rumors, so I'll put that in the show notes.
And there's like tons of just YouTube videos by nerds of like how things work on the rides, if that's a thing you're into, which I am, so you know, you can find that stuff easily too. I have nothing of my own to plug, so I thought to balance out all of the Disney hagiography, I would recommend the podcast You Must Remember This, which is about Hollywood history. And I had never listened before, but this season is all about Song of the South, the famously racist Disney movie. So you can learn all kinds of terrible things about Walt Disney. It's really, really good. Will balance out karmically your Disney Plus subscription.
All right, now it's Tara's turn.
Hi. I watched a show called Back to Life, which is a British import that Showtime has put up all six episodes of at once on their app. It's about Miri Madison, who is played by Daisy Haggard, ex of episodes, who also created the show. She has just returned to her hometown in Kent after serving close to 20 years in prison for murder, which is very incongruous because she's, you know, awkward and gentle and weird and doesn't seem like a murderer. So it's about her integrating back into life in her town, what it's like to live with her parents, you know, getting back in touch with her ex, who's now married and has twins, having a kind of a push-pull relationship with her best friend who survived. The woman who died was her best friend at the time. What it's like for her to try to, you know, seek out work when she has a criminal record and, you know, no work experience because she went away when she was like 18, and the vandalism and abuse that comes from townspeople who, you know, remember her and are not happy that she is back. And it puts a lot of pressure on the show to market it by saying it's from the producers of Fleabag, because it's obviously not as good as Fleabag, but it is good. And one thing I think they have in common is portraying what it's like for a contemporary English woman to interact with older family members. Like, a lot of the jokes, as on Fleabag, arise out of how effectively the protagonists scandalize the people around them by just, you know, saying sassy things and being not British about it. Although at least in this case, there is an actual scandal, obviously, at the heart of the story. But I also could lean harder on the fish out of water aspects of Miri's story as a person coming into modern life, kind of like a time traveler of sorts. Like, when she's interviewing at the fish and chips place in the first episode, he's asking her, you know, if she's interviewing anywhere else. And she just lies, "Oh, yeah, I have an interview at Blockbuster." And he starts laughing and she doesn't know why that's funny because she's been in prison. But it's very judicious in making those kinds of jokes and references. And there's also the mystery that surrounds Lara's death, which unfolds in a compelling and suspenseful way. Like I said, the whole season is up on the app. It's a quick watch. Most episodes are actually under a half an hour. And in that, it has thoughtful things to say about redemption and trauma and the true crime economy, because there's a true crime investigator that's part of this as well, who may or may not be qualified. Spoiler, he's not. He's just a weirdo. And the many ways that there are to, you know, start over in life. So I think it's a rewarding use of a few hours. I watched all of them like in a couple hours yesterday afternoon, and it was really good. So if this was not on your radar, Back to Life on the Showtime app, check it out. If you liked Fleabag, you might like this too.
Sarah.
Speaking of PBS things that you're like, yeah, that's been on the DVR for like 17 months. I should watch that. Why don't we wait for Buncey to watch it and see if we should? Recent episode of POV, Bill Nye, Science Guy. It is about Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
What?
I never actually... I know. That's an outrage. I never watched the actual show. It's not necessary to enjoy this. This one is actually kind of frontline-y in how grim it makes you feel about climate change deniers and Nye basically having to continue being a roadshow as a science statesman, going up against people whose main line of defense against his facts is, "You're not a real scientist." Like dipshits like Ken Ham and his Creation Museum. Barf, why? POV's offerings can be a crapshoot. That's why I'm here, to let you know which ones to watch. This is one of those that, like, if you're someone who watches documentaries to feel good about your own viewpoints, first of all, I get it. I see you. And second of all, you will enjoy this. This is good for that. That is perhaps unkind of me, but this can be a little unfocused in what part of Bill Nye it wants to be about at times, and it may have made a couple of too general moves based on executive notes that didn't serve it as well as they might have, but it is a, you know, frontline-y but less so 90 minutes, and if you watched his show when you were in school, I think you will enjoy reuniting with him. So, POV, Bill Nye, Science Guy, it will be on the PBS app. And speaking of reuniting, I reunited with almost this entire panel at the Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs live episode last week, which, as you're listening to this, provided I can untangle the sound, I think I can do it. And if I can't, you'll just hear Mark's half of things and the audience, which is fine because I had some unpopular opinions about Wilson Phillips. Anyway, that's Mastass Live, episode 165. That will be wherever podcasts are cast as of when you're listening to this tomorrow, Thursday, the 14th of November.
I have two shows to talk about. One is, we talked about The Dark Crystal, I think with Karen, I think maybe mentioned it a couple episodes ago. And I finally watched it when Tara was out of town and I was bored and I was just watching a whole bunch of stuff I probably wouldn't have watched otherwise, including this whole Dark Crystal series.
It was Chris File who talked about it, by the way.
So I watched the whole thing, and then I was like, after, it's like, wow, like, somebody really just wanted to do Dark Crystal the Donald Trump years, because this is basically a coded fantasy about all the shit that's happening today, like autocratic management up top by a totally competent gonzo looking creatures, and they are literally taking the working class and sapping their life force out, then drinking it. And all these other like, you know, little things. There's actually kind of like an ice equivalent in this show. It struck me as kind of weird that Jim Henson would write such a analogy. Not Jim Henson himself, but his company. I thought the show was okay. Adam, you are a big Jim Henson guy. What did you think of it?
I did not like it. I'll probably go back to it at some point. I just think it looks terrible. And I have seen The Dark Crystal recently in a movie theater, like at the Museum of the Moving Image. Like their whole job is to show movies that look good. Mm-hmm. And I've also like seen the puppets on display. Like they look good. It's not like my 5-year-old memory thinking they look good. Mm-hmm. They look good.
Right.
This shit looks creepy and bad. And so like it's not like, oh, it's in HD now. And like it's been, what, 30 years. And I don't understand why it looks worse. Yeah. I think there's also like there's actually not a lot of talking in the original. Mm. And so like the lip sync problems aren't that obvious. And also the writing is not that obvious. Right. Yeah. It's just a lot of like, look at how pretty our world is. And they do a lot of it's just a lot of visual storytelling. And I think I found it really difficult to watch. I'll probably go back to it at some point when I'm bored because I'm kind of curious. But yeah, I was really disappointed in it.
The other show that I watched because Tara wasn't here was the HBO's BBC His Dark Materials, which I knew nothing about. I knew it was like generally one of those young adult reactions to the success of Harry Potter. Don't at me if I'm wrong, but I kind of got that sense. It was like in that wheelhouse.
I think it's earlier.
See? No, nothing. I'm going to try to paint the picture of what this is about based on my limited understanding. It's Earth, but it's not this Earth. It's another Earth. And the only difference is people use cell phones less and everybody has an animal that follows them around everywhere that talks. So the lead character who was the girl that played Little Wolverine in Logan, it's got a little like ferret or something. The ferret talks to them. But here's the weird thing. Up to a certain point in time, their animal companions can shapeshift into any animal. So it can be walking along as a ferret, turn into a bird, fly up to whatever, turn into a bug to listen in a conversation. But then at a certain point, the animal chooses its final form. Why would the animal choose its final form? Why just stay a shapeshifter? It seems to have many more advantages. Never addressed. Because they even had like an animal bar mitzvah in the first episode where it's like the human's now a man and now the animal is also going to choose its final form. It's like, well, that's just a raw deal for everybody involved. I do want to give a shout out. There's this kid. He plays this character called Roger, which is the main lead girl's whose name I totally forget.
Lyra.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I would have to sleep on the lawn if I didn't know that.
Best friend, Roger. This kid actor is fucking amazing. You got to watch it just to see Roger in action. This kid's got to be 8 or 9. He's acting like he's fucking 40. He's got like so much range. His face acting is spot on. This guy's got to win an Emmy or a BAFTA or whatever. The other notes I made is that the villains in the show are called the Gobblers, which is just like the most British villain organization name ever. The Gobblers? You know, oh, come on. The other question I have, maybe somebody who read the books can answer. Why can't the animal daemons also just turn into people? Because they seem like they have all the tools. They can turn into monkeys. They can change their size when they turn into different things. So I figured, like, why can't they just be people? Maybe they are. Maybe everybody's an animal. We just don't know it in this universe.
Shout out to James McAvoy's sweaters.
Recommendation, if you do watch the show, it is a show to watch with subtitles on because there is a lot of gentle English whispering.
It's not like this, and you know, we have to go into the shed and find the shovel.
What? All right, everybody, it is time for the canon. Adam is submitting this week, but I just want to give a note. Adam is submitting one episode. We had a user submission that was for this episode and something else at the same time. So Adam is going to do his presentation. He might refer to some of the points that our submitter made, but you can also listen to that user submission. I'll tack it on to the end of the show since there's a lot of overlap with what Adam is going to say. Adam, take it away.
Well, we'll consider it a team submission. I'm going to quote her. Thank you, Eleanor. We actually made a lot of the same points. So I will. I have incorporated a few of them and, you know, yay, teamwork. So, a couple of weeks ago, during game time, Sarah besmirched the good name of Grey's Anatomy, which, yes, is still on, and yes, I still watch it. And I realized that somehow, how dare you, none of its 338 and counting episodes was in the canon yet, and this injustice cannot stand. I had fun rewatching some early episodes I hadn't seen in 15 years, and thank you to Joe Reed and Amy Spaulding for their help making a short list. And I considered submitting a more run-of-the-mill one with multiple medical cases and plots, but decided to go with one of the show's most famous event episodes, which in fact aired after the Super Bowl, which used to be a thing, kids ask your parents, because those are also a hallmark of the series, and one, this one in particular helped really put Grey's on the map. It's a great showcase for these characters and these actors, and a great indication that of all that the show would be going forward and is to this day. This episode is season 2, episode 17, as we know it. As Dave mentioned, this is technically the second half of a two-parter, but I think it stands alone with a little help from the previous leads, and I didn't want to make you do all of that work. So here's what you really need to know going into part 2. The main characters are all still interns. Miranda Bailey, the tough-as-nails head of their program, is in labor, but her husband was in a car accident on the way to the hospital, and she's refusing to push until he's out of surgery. And for reasons that don't matter, a man has been brought into the ER with an unexploded bomb in his chest. Paramedic Christina Ricci had her hand on his heart and by extension the bomb, keeping it from shifting and therefore exploding, but she panicked and fled the room. Meredith Grey, without thinking, grabbed it in her place, which is where we are when the episode starts, and clip 1.
You realize how stupid that was?
It was, Mayor. Incredibly stupid.
Okay, you know when you don't need to be made fun of? Like when you have your hand inside a body that's got a bomb in it and a stranger is velcroing a flak jacket to your boobs.
You've got a sense of irony.
Only when things are really ironic.
This little clip tells us so much about Meredith and her state of mind and her relationship with Christina, and even guest star Kyle Chandler as the bomb squad guy. Right after this, Bert comes into the OR and insists that Christina leave because he can't concentrate on the surgery if he's worried about her blowing up. I was never the biggest Burke fan, and he got kicked off the show for good reason not long after this, but this is peak Grey's Anatomy relationship time, before the recoupling's character death got ridiculous, and it's a great tiny moment for all three of them. Here are the rest of the things that I think make this episode canon-worthy. It's peak Meredith. I admit that back when this aired, Meredith was probably the character I had the least interest in on the show. But I love how she's grown over the years, and looking back, it was all there from the start. And Ellen Pompeo does so much without being able to move, and often with just her eyes over a surgical mask. She plays Meredith's simultaneous bravery and terror perfectly. To quote listener submitter Eleanor, this episode is the first where we get a real glimpse of Meredith's inner darkness, as well as her role as the moral core of the show. Clip 2.
Well, I need one of you to tell me what this means exactly. Because I think I know what it means. But I tend to be glass half empty these days, so I won't trust what I think it means. Because what I think it means is that if the bomb were to explode over the oxygen line, the whole hospital could blow up. And that's just crazy, right?
That is crazy, and that's why I love Grey's Anatomy. This episode is also peak Christina. The one thing that made me hesitate about submitting this episode was that the relatively small amount of Christina, because Christina is the best, but it's still a great showcase for her. This scene manages to cut the tension, provide soap opera exposition, and a great glimpse of Meredith and Christina's friendship. Clip 3, please.
Tell me something.
What?
Christina, I have my hand on a bomb. I'm freaking out. And most importantly, I really have to pee. Tell me anything.
He told me he loved me. Last night, he thought I was sleeping, but I heard him say it.
Burke loves you.
Yeah. Mind your own business.
Burke loves you.
Yeah, everybody has problems.
Well, are you gonna say it back, or?
Of course not. He didn't say it to me. He said it to the sleeping me. Reciprocity is not required. Besides, he might blow up.
Excellent point.
Peak Addison, and by extension, all the grown-up surgeons. Clip 4, please.
Dr. Montgomery Shepherd. What are we going to do? I mean, about Dr. Bailey. Can we drug her?
Against her will?
No. Well, yes. I mean, can't we force her to push? Declare her temporarily insane?
You want me to declare Miranda Bailey incompetent? Do you think that'll help? Do you think it'll make her more inclined, more comfortable giving birth?
I don't know. That's
do you think I'm not doing everything I can to help her? I mean, do you think I'm just out here because, I don't know, I'm feeling a little lazy, just need a little me time?
I'm just asking.
Stop asking! Because no matter what you ask, the answer is, I don't know. I'm doing everything I can. Everything I can. Miranda Bailey's husband is in mortal danger, actual mortal danger, and there's not a lot I can say to comfort her right now because there's not a lot anybody can say to comfort me. I'm doing my best. Dr. Bailey is doing her best, and I need you to do your best, and I need it to be better than standing here asking me the world's stupidest questions. I don't know, O'Malley.
With all of Seattle Grace's top surgeons in surgery or in crisis or both, Addison articulates something that's true for all of them and is also one of the show's core tenets. These surgeons are incredibly skilled and also incredibly cocky, but they're human, and they get scared and they care about their friends. From a character standpoint, it says so much about Addison and Bailey and how Addison sees her. Unlike Grey's, I gave up on private practice a couple seasons in, but I always loved this version of Addison and get happy whenever Kate Walsh is up on my TV still because of her. This episode is peak Bailey. We see her vulnerable but still tough, even if that toughness is in this case irrational. Chandra Wilson is so good. This isn't really a Bailey clip, but in the early seasons, she was largely defined by her relationship to her students. So when George rises to the occasion, it's well earned for both of them. Clip 5.
You're Dr. Bailey. You don't hide from a fight. You don't give up. You strive for greatness. You, Dr. Bailey, you are a doer. I know your husband's not here, and I know there are a lot of things going on here that we have no control over. But this. This. We can do. Okay.
And then, clip 6.
Oh, Dr. Bailey, I can see the top of his head. He's got a lot of hair.
Oh, he's cute.
O'Malley?
Yeah?
Stop looking at my vajayjay.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, this is the episode that, for better or for worse, gave the world vajayjay. Love it or hate it, it is iconic. Peak everybody else. Clip 7.
I feel like colors are brighter. Does anyone feel like colors are brighter? My head hurts.
It's adrenaline. You have the smell thing? Because I have like this crazy...
Shut up!
Are you okay?
Of course she's not okay. How could she possibly be okay? You're insensitive.
I'm not insensitive.
Would you two just shut up? Nobody cares if the blue is blue or if you have super smelling powers. Meredith could die. Any minute she could just... die. Actually stop living.
You know what?
Dead.
Oh.
Corpse. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. God, I have really inappropriate reactions to this kind of stress. I'm sorry, hold on. Okay? Yeah.
Should we do something? I mean, call Meredith's family?
We are Meredith's family. I'm sorry. We are Meredith's family.
I thought that clip was shorter. I was so excited to defend Katherine Heigl and Tiara Knight, who were both great on this show, and I don't think they get enough credit, and watching this again reminded me to be angry about the stupid way they killed George and the banishment of Izzy to the land of then they never saw her again. I will note that Eleanor called George and Izzy, quote, two of the most annoying characters in the history of television, but this episode is well before the Denny of it all, and at least for now, I will respectfully disagree with her. In 2019, Meredith and Alex are the only two remaining characters, remaining members of their intern class, and their friendship is still at the core of the show. I love getting to see the original group go through this together. And the scene at the end where Christina and Izzy help a literally shell-shocked Meredith shower is beautiful. They successfully kept Meredith surrounded by amazing female friendships for the entire series, but none will ever live up to this original trio for me. This is peak Shonda Rhimes. She wrote this episode and it shows. She's been excellent at cultivating writers who can ape her style, but none of her shows is ever as good as when she's writing it. The music. Grey's became known, not always positively, for its, to quote Eleanor again, famous use of weepy indie songs to make us feel all our feelings at once. But I was struck here not just by the songs and the score, but how they're used, the way they drop out and come back in moments to help really tell the story and create tension or a false sense of security. The guest stars. Christina Ricci and Kyle Chandler are both great. I don't have much more to say about that, but the show's excellence in casting, from well-known actors to Hey, It's That Guys, continues to this day. We also get recurring guest star Loretta Devine in this episode, and that always makes a good Grace for me. The climax. Grace didn't invent cross-cutting between multiple high-drama scenes while a pop song plays, but they still do an amazing job at it. The big sequence of Derek and Christina operating on Bailey's flatlining husband and Meredith Burke and Kyle Chandler removing the bomb, all while Bailey gives birth, is a masterpiece. And then the twist. Normally on Grey's, when there are three cases of the week, you know one of them will end badly, or whoever the patient was is fine, but their husband drops dead of an aneurysm or something. But for as tense as the bomb stuff is, you know they're not going to kill the titular Grey. We're led to believe Bailey's husband is a goner, which would be the show's normal route. But then boom, literally. After we think we're in the clear, the bomb explodes and goodbye, Kyle Chandler. It's masterfully structured, even knowing what's coming. And not for nothing, but the vajayjay moment happens during this intense sequence, and I think it shows a lot of confidence that they felt they could put that comedy beat there. So in conclusion, Grey's Anatomy has proven its staying power, and despite some dips in quality that are inevitable in such a long run, has remained, on the whole, a really good show. This episode is an example of Grey's in its prime, with excellent writing, acting, and direction, balancing soapiness and real heart and complex characters. It laid the groundwork for not only the rest of the series, but multiple imitators and the entire Shonda Rhimes empire, and I believe it should be in the canon.
Well, since Sarah was the one who inspired this presentation, I feel like she should go first.
I probably should. Warning, there's a rogue Pomeranian in my office, so I'll try to keep this short.
Poppies!
I think that there's something to be said for when I was doing the Oscars death race, like almost a decade ago, I remember complaining in one of my reviews, like, why do people always shit on the Transformers for Megan Fox's acting? Because like she's doing what she needs to do in the role and she's fine. Like you can't compare Transformer movies to, or you can't grade them using the same curve as you use for, like, I don't know,
King Lear,
yes, Atonement. So I tried very hard to keep an open mind to what makes this canonical for this show. And I think that presentation was excellent. But I think I have like a limited number of this kind of show in me. And there is no room for this. I was happy to see Jillian Armanante again. I thought all the guest stars were great. Kyle Chandler, before he got smithereened, you know, always a fox. But I'm not sure how I'm going to vote, because I think that this is peak everything, like you said. But so much of it is just so... No, like the, okay, like how many, it was like four different musical montages that I'm like, oh my God, go away. Like I have no kick with Katherine Heigl as a person, as figure in the culture, but her character, Jesus, like at least this wasn't a fucking a ghost episode. Thanks for that. I think the world of Ellen Pompeo's performance in The Law and Order, where she's basically Carla Homolka, but I can never get past it now. So I'm always just kind of like thinking of her giving that line rating of like, did you find a bracelet? I'd like to get that back. Like I don't know, but this show is not for me. And I think everything that people love about it is what I don't care for. But I also think that there's a place in the canon for shows that are loved like a misshapen stuffed animal. So I don't actually know what I'm going to do. This was enjoyable to watch because of the things about it that I don't care for, though, strangely. Like Dawson's Creek was much easier to recap than The Sopranos, and not just because they were shorter. But yeah, like... It depends on what you mean by canonical. I didn't want to watch another one, but that's not the only metric. So I'm interested. I know Tara was, you watched the show for a while, right?
I watched the first 3 or 4 seasons.
Okay. Well, that's like 15 more seasons than I watched. So I'm going to throw it to you for a more experiential viewpoint.
Okay. I mean, there definitely is a lot to rankle about this. I mean, for JJ, you're right. It is like, it's a TV history moment, but ugh. I mean, don't encourage Oprah to not use proper anatomical words for body parts. Like she had a big, she had a big megaphone and that's not a word she should have been saying into it, frankly. So I blame Shonda Rhimes for that.
Fair.
At least this isn't a You're My Person episode, so fine. And I thought the clip that you played with the girl talk while they're rolling the gurney was like, oh, this is really asinine. Like, this is not what people would do and is silly. And I know that you have to get this in somehow, but this is not the way. And I had forgotten how the style of these shows, because I haven't watched one in so long. I mean, I watched Scandal a lot longer than I watched this. But I'd forgotten how she's like an Aaron Sorkin writer or Amy Sherman Palladino, where like every character talks the same, like too much. It has that talky talk.
Yeah.
Dialogue true. Style. Although I relaxed about it faster in this than I have in other similar sorts of things. But that said, there is a lot of good in this episode. Like it really is gripping. I mean, Meredith, I like that you called out her acting over her mask, because that's really hard to do. And she really does, Ellen Pompeo really does do an amazing job. And I definitely bought her terror, but also her matter of factness. And the moment, right when they're just about to pull the bomb out, and she suddenly says George and Izzy shouldn't have to move out, like she's making her wishes known in case she blows up, because she really could blow up. And I also thought, like, when you cast a Kyle Chandler, even though this is pre-Friday Night Lights Kyle Chandler, like, clearly if you're a viewer watching this, you're like, oh, this is the new love interest for Meredith, probably, because at this point, Addison has come back. It's not going to work out with her and Derek. So here's this other cute guy, and they also have a, you know, kind of crackly, like, sparry energy between them, and then he blows up. It's like, fuck! Remember how jarring that was, because it really was a huge, huge surprise. Like he was at that point, like, just famous enough where you thought, like, okay, he could be like a recurring cast member. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then, no.
I did jump. I did not expect that. I didn't know it was going to happen. So,
yeah. But that, I mean, that and like the where is she moment with Derek and Addison and Mrs. Henry from 90210 saying that wasn't the she he was referring to. That
Mrs. was really Henry, well done too. I'm so like, glad someone else had him as that in their nose.
Yeah.
Now and forever.
I mean, like this, all of the medical catastrophes and how they're all interrelated and how, you know, which personnel are doing what and who's left out of it. And like, this is what you watch a medical procedural for. So I get why you would pick this for as like an excellent exemplar of a Grey's episode, because it really is. And the echo, I mean, this, you said this is part two of a two-parter, and we saw in the previouslys, you know, the moment that kicked it off right after the Super Bowl was George's fantasy of the three women in the shower, and the way they call back to that at the end is, I mean, obviously it's constructed for that reason. Like, it's not like it's an accident, but the book ending the episode, the two-parter with those two moments, I thought was really strong. So I thought it was an excellent pick. So good job, Adam. Dave.
Thanks.
All right. Let me tell you why this is canon worthy. This is the first episode of Grey's Anatomy I've ever watched. This is actually the only episode of Grey's Anatomy that I knew anything about prior to today. I knew there was one where a guy had a mortar shell stuck in his stomach. I knew this because we were on still running TWOP at the time, and I thought I should do a shirt that is just the Operation Game guy, except there's a mortar shell in his stomach, and that would be the shirt. Mm-hmm. Never got around to it. I think this is peak white wine television.
Yep.
I feel like it hits all those spots. You know, it has relationships that are in crises and they are pushed to resolution because crazy shit is happening. And all the crazy shit that's happening really reminded me of a crisis ER episode. Like, this felt very ER-y to me, and I know this is an outliner for Grey's Anatomy, but I feel like this is definitely a Grey's Anatomy in the ER mode, but with more white wine in it, right? And
for sure,
when you approach it from that standpoint, much in the way that when there was a Beverly Hills 90210 or whatever other junk TV that's in the canon got in the canon, it's because it, like, it's a niche we watch, and for that, it's really good. It might not be Citizen Kane, but it doesn't need to be, right? It just needs to be good at what it wants to do. And this kind of it sets out to be manipulative, jarring, surprising, weepy, and it does all those things. I also didn't know that Coach Taylor blows up at the end. There's a scene where you can kind of see Ground Zero. It's a little bit out of focus, but boy, there is a lot of pink mist and goo in there. Like, they really went for it when they blew that guy up. I do agree, Tara. I also didn't like the part of the rolling down scene where Dr. Sandra Oh's character comes in, Dr. Yang.
Dr. Eve.
But previous to that, I thought that scene was really great, just slowly rolling that gurney down. The music was very, like, boop, boop, boop. So I just think, like, for what Grey's Anatomy sets out to do, I think this episode, like, checked all the boxes. And then at the end, a fucking guy blows up. And let's not forget about the whole premise of this episode and the two-parter. The guy managed to get a fucking mortar stuck in his stomach, and they have to perform surgery. And the only way they can really do it without blowing up the whole hospital is to go have a hand inside this guy's stomach, pull out the shell like it's obscene from the Hurt Locker. And on top of all that, you got those ERS things like, well, I guess there's an oxygen line under this. And the administrator that's taking care of all of this, he's having a panic attack, or maybe it's a heart attack. Like, there's all these similar little character moments that revolve around the big crises that really reminded me of ER, except Grey's Anatomy is like, it did ER plus it did Grey's Anatomy at the same time. So I think this episode is more than the sum of its parts. That is my argument. So with that, let us put the official vote. I will say yay. Let's work backwards. Tara Ariana?
I will say yay as well.
All right, that's two. And Sarah D. Bunting?
Doesn't matter, but Dave talked me into it.
Yeah.
So that's a yay for me.
All right.
Yay.
All right, that means Grey's Anatomy Season 2, Episode 17, as we know it, is hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Grey Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Sarah has the winner.
I sure do. It's Amazon's A League of Their Own, which has cast Darcy Carden and Abby Jacobson. And if you follow me on Twitter, that's at Tomato Nation, you know that over the weekend I got Poppy Fields movied again by A League of Their Own, which was on some distant Showtime, watched the entire thing again, and then was just bitching about Kit again. So I'm really looking forward to this series being addressing some of my objections to that character and the ending. And I didn't realize that Penny Marshall had given this project her blessing before she passed. Aww. So that's good news, I feel.
That's good too.
And Gina Davis as well. So
I feel like this could be your Mandalorian.
Could be.
Tara has our loser.
Of my own.
Yeah.
Oh, loser is Donald Cherry. Oh, Don.
Oh, buddy.
So Don Cherry, like decades of vintage Hockey Night in Canada commentator, former player, probably, definitely a former coach or manager or whatever the fuck.
I don't think he ever played. Yeah, he's just
Periodically you will hear about Don Cherry even in America because he has said something fucking stupid or offensive. And this is no exception. During his Hockey Night appearance over the weekend, I'm reading now from Deadline.com, Cherry noted how he was not seeing certain people in Canada wearing the customary remembrance poppies on their lapels in the lead up to, they call it Armistice Day. In Canada, it's called Remembrance Day. But anyway, so here's what Don said. You people, you love our way of life. You love our milk and honey. At least you can pay a couple of bucks for a poppy or something like that. These guys paid for your way of life that you enjoy in Canada. These guys paid the biggest price. So, like, leaving aside the whole issue of that I assume he doesn't know about, because why would he have, like, you know, there's kind of been a backlash to the poppy. It was sort of a nationalist symbol that John McCrae glamorized in the poem on in Flanders Fields. You know, it's got a kind of, you know, rough history that people don't really know about. And there's also a lot of social pressure to like just put a poppy on, even though some people would prefer to wear a white poppy because that's a symbol of peace. But whatever, for some reason, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. And Don Cherry has finally been fired from Hockey Night in Canada. So it's truly the end of an era.
It basically is sort of the same story arc as Duck Dynasty. It's like they kept on saying stupid shit. They would apologize for it in a half-ass, not really meaning it way. And then eventually there was something that the straw that broke the camel's back, and they kind of disappeared from the main airways, but, you know, still exists. And that's what Don Cherry's face going to be, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your CanCon for this episode.
But bringing it back around, there's a very funny, sorry, go ahead. I'm going to ruin your perfect game-time segue. Nope, do it.
Now it's too late. Now you ruined it. Now I got to build off what you say. So make it good.
There's a very funny Disney Plus, fake Disney Plus Twitter account that did a Don Cherry thing with the Muppet Uncle Deadly.
Oh,
which feels very rude to Uncle Deadly, frankly, but that's all.
Speaking about things that are deadly, do you know what time it is?
There you go.
Time.
Who's Uncle Deadly?
The Vincent Pricey one.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. All right, guys, this is the third game time of the season. Scores currently are Sarah, 1 point. Value Guess, 1 point. Tara, 0 points. Today we are playing, and this has been in reserve waiting for Adam's return.
Oh, no.
We are playing Jazz Hands from John C., who earns himself an extra credit topic of his choice. All right, he writes, "It is not an original observation that many TV actors come from the musical theater and have been on Broadway. Nevertheless, note that we have. In this game, you will hear brief clips of TV actors singing, in most cases in actual Broadway shows, and a few just singing musical theater songs in general. After each clip, you must name the TV actor for 2 points. If you guess incorrectly or you don't know, I'll give you a hint in the form of the TV show this actor is well known for, after which the correct answer is worth 1 point. Make sense?
Yes. So much pressure.
I feel attacked, but
if
yes.
If you don't win this, Adam, you're never coming back on the show.
I think that's probably fair.
If I win this, I'm never coming back on the show. Booyah. Also, I said booyah, sorry.
Steal most situation, please, Tara.
Thank you, Dave. I have 0. Sarah has 1. Valued Guests went into this with 1. But after the latest Extra Extra Hot Great, in which I believe Kevin was our victor, and he, or I can't remember if he won, but anyway, whoever won the tiebreaker got to gift a steel meal to the player of their choice, and he gifted it to the Valued Guests. So Valued Guests have 2 steel meals.
All right, let's throw it to Picky to see who will be going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right, our order today, Tara, Sarah, Adam, are we ready to play Jazz Hands? Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
Yep.
Here we go. Tara, here is your first clip. Remember, you need to identify the TV actor singing.
Mama who bore me, mama who gave me no way to handle things, who made me so sad.
Well, that's clearly a clip from Rise, our favorite show. Just kidding. I think that's probably Lea Michele from Glee.
You are correct. Now, here's the second part of the game. Doesn't count towards your points, but Tara, I'm going to need you to create a second tally for everybody.
Okay.
Ooh.
If you can tell me the play that that clip is from, you will get a play point, which can be exchanged at the end of the game for prizes.
Okay. That's Spring Awakening.
Spring Awakenings is correct. All right. So 2 points for your answer and 1 play point. Sarah D. Bunting, are you ready for your first Broadway song?
Sure.
There was a barber and his wife, and she was beautiful. A foolish barber and his wife, she was his reason and his life.
All right, so we're looking for the TV actor.
I don't actually know, so Robert Guillaume.
That is incorrect. So now I will give you a TV show this actor has been in a major way. The TV show is Blue Bloods.
Is it Len Carreyrou?
That is correct. Okay. 1 point. Now for one play point, what's that musical?
I don't know.
You can say it just for shits and giggles since you seem to
know
it.
It's Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd, correct. All right, Adam, here is your first clip.
I'm as faithful as they come, but in my dreams I live each moment to the maximum. I do the clubs, I've got the moves, I'm where the bright lights are, and I play the bass guitar.
What the fuck?
I thought I knew it at the beginning, and then at the end I had no idea.
I knew the first two.
All right, so no idea?
No.
All right, I'm going to let you know that this actor who just played that song was in a show called Quantum Leap.
Oh, it's Bacula.
Blah.
Bacula.
Wow. Good for 1 point. Now, do you know the production?
No.
The production was Romance. Romance.
Oh, yeah. A show I don't know at all. Okay.
Tara, here we go. Second clip coming at you.
There's not a tune you can hum. There's not a tune you go bum, 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 da. You need a tune to go bum, 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 da. Give me a melody. Why can't you throw them a crumb? What's wrong with letting them tap their toes a bit?
I think that's Jason Alexander.
Good for two.
Nice.
Now, what's that production?
I don't know, so I'm going to guess Damn Yankees.
Incorrect. Anybody
what
else?
Is it, Adam? You know.
It is Merrily We Roll Along.
Merrily We Roll Along is the correct answer. Sarah D. Bunting, are you ready?
Yeah.
Why look so awfully tragic? Put on a happy face. Smiling can work like magic. Put on a happy face. Take off the gloomy mask of tragedy. It's not your style. You look so good that you'll be glad you decided to smile.
Is that Dick Van Dyke?
Correct. Yeah.
2 points. Do you know what production that is?
I don't, but I'll just guess Singing in the Rain. Why not?
Incorrect. Anybody?
Mm-mm.
I think it's Bye Bye Birdie.
Bye Bye Birdie. Adam is correct.
Okay.
All right, Adam, you didn't get your first one, so here is your second.
Let me go far away, somewhere they won't never find me, and tomorrow won't remind me of today. When the city's finally sleeping and the moon looks old and gray, I get on a train that's bound for Santa Fe.
Christian Bale. No, just kidding. Jeremy Jordan.
Jeremy Jordan is correct. I know it's not the same guy, but all right.
Jeremy Jordan. All right.
And what is that production?
Newsies.
Newsies is correct.
Nice. Okay.
Back to Tara.
Yes.
I believe that the Lord God created the universe. I believe that he sent his only son to die for my sins. And I believe that ancient Jews built boats and sailed to America.
I think that's Andrew Rannells.
You're correct.
Okay. And I think that's Book of Mormon.
Yeah, it is Book of Mormon. Or as the typo says in this answer that I created, the Bach of Mormon, which is like a chicken version of it.
An all chicken cast. Yep. That's my favorite one.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to our large Book of Mormon tote bag that was a gift from Adam Grossworth.
That's right. Still using
I love
it to
that
this
tote
day.
Bag. Yeah, I still have yep. mine too.
We are back to Sarah.
Sarah.
Here you go.
The man in the moon. A lady, with lipstick.
Took me a second.
And a curse.
B. What Arthur?
You are correct for 2 points. Do you know the production?
I mean, I know what it's not. So, no, I don't
what
know.
What is it not?
It's not Showboat.
You're correct, it's not. You don't get any points, but you're yes. technically correct, the best kind of correct. Anybody know what that is?
No.
I was hoping you do, because the answer is missing, because I made a, I pressed the space bar when it was going on. I want to say it was called Ma'am or something like that.
Ma'am? It might be Ma'am. Oh, yeah, Ma'am. She was in Ma'am.
Ma'am, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Ma'am.
I was going from memory. Well, you know, I don't know. All right, back to Adam. I guess I could have pressed undo.
I appreciate that you're giving me the hard ones, but I'm going to need the hint.
This TV actor was in a TV show called Sex in the City.
Oh, that's Sarah Jessica Parker.
That's correct for 1 point. And the production?
Is it Once Upon a Mattress?
It's Annie. It's I finally knew one.
Is it? Why is there a recording? I've heard it. Whatever. It doesn't matter.
All right. To Tara.
And the care and the feeling,
no fair,
and the light moving on.
Well, that's definitely Mandy Patinkin.
Good for two.
And I don't know the show, but based on the context of the lyrics, I'm going to guess it's Sunday in the Park with George.
You are correct. Well done. Adam was very angry he didn't get that one.
Yeah, he was pissed. I could It's a very distinctive voice.
That's why, yes.
Would have got that one.
Yes.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, here you go.
Give them the old razzle dazzle.
Aww.
Razzle dazzle. Give them an act with lots of flash in it, and the reaction will be passionate.
All right, who's that actor?
Oh, I'm going to be mad, but I need the hint.
All right. This actor...
Wait, Sarah, think about it for a second.
All right, Adam wants you to think about it for a second. Okay, she needs a hint.
Okay.
Law and Order.
Oh, there he is. Is that Mr. Jerry Orbach? May he rest.
Is correct.
His corny eyes. Thank you.
What's the production?
Oh, shit. I don't actually know, but let's go with the odds. The Fantastics?
That's incorrect. The answer we're looking for? Chicago.
Oh, Chicago. Okay.
All right, this is our last question before our first score break. It is for Adam.
And there was this dear, sweet, clearly respectable, thickly bespectacled man who stood by my side and quietly said to me, "Ma'am, don't mean to intrude, but I was just wondering, are you in need of some help?" I said, "No, yes, I am."
Now I'm going to be mad. Is it Jane Krakowski?
It is. 2 points.
Balls.
Song of the summer. What's the production?
It's not Starlight Express.
It's Thank you for that.
It's not Company. Just going to name all the shows she was in. I don't know.
He doesn't know. The answer was She Loves Me.
Oh, yeah. Saw her in there.
All right, Tara, that brings us to our first score break, so please, this scores.
Okay, well, I have 8 points. Sarah and Adam are tied with 6 points each.
I should start referring to as not scores, but the original broadcast recordings.
Ah!
Womp womp.
Boo. All right, we are back to Tara. Here is your next TV actor singing Broadway.
Yet there's that up... turn chin and the grin of impetuous youth. I believe in you. I believe in you.
That's Robert Morse?
Correct.
Nice.
Okay, is that from How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying? I wasn't sure of the rest of the title.
Correct.
So I trailed off.
That is Bert Cooper from Mad Men, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. Sarah D. Bunting, your next one coming at you.
No matter what you do, I'm on your side. And if my point of view is somewhat misty-eyed, there's nothing clearer in my life than what I wish and feel for you. And that's a lot, no matter what.
Is it, I mean, is it Kelsey Grammer?
It kind of does sound like Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah, it does sound like him.
Okay.
The TV show we're looking for is Happy Days. Somebody from Happy Days sung that.
Aaron Moran, JK.
Somebody from Happy Days. Let me just give you the first little bit.
No matter what you do, I'm on your side.
TV actor from Happy Days.
Tom Bosley.
Correct for 1 point.
Yeah.
Production, any idea?
Continuing not to be Showboat? No, I have no idea.
Anybody on the panel know that one?
No.
Beauty and the Beast is correct.
Oh.
Adam something, here is your next song.
Mind you, I can't hardly blame them. These are probably the worst pies in London. I know why nobody cares to take them. I should know, I make them, but good. Worst pies in London.
All right, who is that actor singing?
Angela Lansbury.
That's
Sweeney Todd.
She wrote. Angela Lansbury is correct, and Sweeney Todd was the production. That's good for 2 points and a production point, or whatever the hell we were calling those. Tara Ariano.
Yes.
Here is your clip.
Daddy never knew that you were on your way. He had other ladies and other tunes to play. When he up and left me, I just up and run. Only thing in my head, you were your daddy's son.
Oh.
So much lip syncing happening over here.
I could listen to that all day. That's Audra McDonald. Is it Porgy and Bess? Shit.
Incorrect.
What is it, Adam?
Ragtime.
Ragtime is correct. All right, now this is question number 17.
The Spread Eagle.
And it is for Sarah.
I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance.
Ooh. Finally, I know the show. I don't know this actor. Is that Patti LuPone?
Correct.
Oh, Queen.
Life Goes On. Deadly. What the hell was it? Penny Dreadful? She was in that.
Oh, mm-hmm. Right. I was going to ask what the clue was. I don't think of her as a TV
Life Goes On
person.
Was the clue I would have given her.
But. Right.
Okay. And repeat defense attorney on Law & Order. That's Vita.
You are correct.
My one play point that I'll get.
Yeah, 2 points in.
Well done.
Play point. I don't know why I called them play points. These are plays. That's how much I know about Broadway. Back to Adam Grossworth.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine, I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those stumble bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer first rate chums I attract.
I think you're trying to trick me, and that is Christina Applegate.
Wow.
Nice.
You are correct for 2 points, and the production?
Sweet Charity.
Sweet Charity is correct. Nicely done. This is question 19. And it is for Tara. Are you ready, Tara?
Yes.
Open your door, I'll be your tenant. Don't got much baggage to lay at your feet, but sweet kisses I've got to spare. I'll be there and I'll cover you.
I think that's Little Shop of Horrors.
Let's take that part last.
Okay. I don't know who the actor is.
All right. Your clue for the actor is he was on Law and Order.
Really narrows it down.
Okay.
There's no repeat actors.
Okay.
Law and Order.
This feels like a crazy guess. Is it Chris Noth?
Steel Mail.
Oh. Steel Mail from Adam, and this is for 1 point.
That's only for 1 point. You sure you want to use it?
Oh, what are the scores?
12-9 for Sarah. To you have 10.
Just.
I mean, I'm not going to do it. You should do it.
I just feel like I can't lose this game. I'll be humiliated. It's Jesse L. Martin in Rent.
Jesse L. Martin is correct.
Oh.
Now I'm going to extend to you the production point. What's the production?
Rent.
He said Rent. Yeah.
Correct.
Good job.
That is a Steel Mail bonus for Adam. And now we're on to Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
I like the island Manhattan.
I know you do.
Smoke on your pipe and put lead in.
Is that National Treasure Rita Moreno?
Woo!
You are correct.
In West Side Story?
And West Side Story. Correct on both accounts.
Technically, that's the movie.
All right.
We are now through all the musicals that I know. Luck to us all.
Adam Sternberg. Sternberg. Jesus Christ. Adam Grossworth, are you ready for your next question?
Yes. It's fine. I like Adam Sternberg a lot.
Yeah, we're going to cut that out. Don't you worry about it.
Come on, babe. Why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz, start the car, I know a whoopee spot.
Ms. Bebe Neuwirth.
Good for two.
In Chicago.
That is correct. Well done. Back to Tara.
We'll take a glass together in celebration of our meeting.
That's Nathan Lane. No? Okay.
Wow.
Is he correct? The TV show we're looking for?
So it's Schmathan Schmain.
Your TV show clue is Evening Shade. I'm going to give you another clue. It's not Burt Reynolds.
Okay. Is it Michael Jeter? Okay.
That is good for one. And do you know the production?
Well, I thought I did, but I was going to confidently say, well, that's the producers. I have no idea what it is.
Anybody?
I think it's Grand Hotel.
Grand Hotel, yes.
Oh, Jesus.
I didn't.
Sarah D. Bunting, here is your next clip.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now knows anything goes. Good authors too, who once knew better words, now only use four letter words, writing prose. Anything goes.
I'm gonna be mad, but I need a hint.
Okay, your hint is Bunheads.
That doesn't help. Robert Guillaume.
All right, we're looking for Sutton Foster.
Oh, right. Of
production,
course.
Production, any idea?
Anything goes?
I don't know. There you go.
Correct.
Yes.
Yay.
All right. We are back to Adam Grossworth, and this will take us into our second score break. Here is your clip.
Welcome to my party. Glad you like the dress. Welcome to my party.
Baby, where's the ice?
Who here's up for dancing? Who here's new? Welcome to my party. Who the hell invited you?
Think that's Toni Collette.
That is good for two.
Wow.
From The Wild Party.
That is correct. Cross the
board.
Wow. Damn.
Nicely done. All right. That's going to take us into our second score break near the end of our game. Tara, scores, please. Tara, original broadcast cast recording, please.
Okay. Sarah has 11 points. I have 13 points. Adam just pulled further ahead with 15.
Back into it. Everybody has two questions left.
Oh, God.
Starting with Tara.
Let them cry, dirty traitor. They will understand it later. The country is not what it was.
That's Victor Garber.
I was wondering when he would get
That's
here.
That's probably Assassins.
It is Assassins. You are correct across the board.
It's a Little Mermaid.
Godspell.
Starlight Express.
All right, Sarah, here is your penultimate question coming at you. What is going on here?
The chaotic life of a 12-year-old is too hard and you never know what's coming next. But in spelling,
things have logic and line.
And in spelling,
there's some greater design.
All right, we're looking for the male voice there.
Hint.
Modern Family. It's not the little kid.
It's not Sofia Vergara.
Nope.
It's probably not Ed O'Neill.
Is it Ed O'Neill? Survey says it is not. Anybody else?
Oh, wait. That? It's Ferguson.
All right. We'll give that to you. 1 point.
Jesse Tyler. He has a bunch of names.
Yep. Jesse
wow,
Tyler.
Wow. Those
Ferguson.
Are all three.
Yeah. Great. Good job.
I'll give you a day point for getting all three names.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. We are to Adam.
Wait. Here, she has a chance to say the play.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of
She's
course.
She's not going to know
I
the
forgot
play.
I buzzed you. But yeah, good luck with this one. I'll give you a hint. It's the
home.
Second longest title
oh,
in our game.
It played in the same theater, Sarah. Good job.
Thanks.
Adam, you wanna, Adam, can you get it correct?
The 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee.
Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah, of course.
All right. To Adam, here is your clip.
I got a sweet tooth for licorice drops and jelly roll. Hey, sugar daddy, Hansel needs some sugar in his bowl.
All right, what TV actor are we hearing there?
Neil Patrick Harris.
You are correct. And what is the production?
Hedwig und the Angry Inch.
Correct. Well done. All right. Everybody's last question.
I can't believe Cop Rock hasn't showed up yet.
Is here.
None of those people were on Broadway. They can't sing.
No, it's true.
All right, Tara, here you go.
Okay.
I'll help you be popular. You'll hang with the right cohorts. You'll be good at sports. Know the slang you've got to know. So let's start, because you've got an awfully long way to go.
That's Kristen Chenoweth.
Correct.
In Wicked.
That is also correct. All right. Sarah Bunting, here is your last clip.
I'm just a Broadway baby, walking off my tired feet, pounding 42nd Street to be in a show.
Hint.
The Good Fight.
Oh, Baranski?
Baranski, correct for 1 point. Do you know the production?
42nd Street?
Incorrect. Anybody?
Mm-mm.
Follies.
Follies is correct from Adam. Follies. All right, our last clip of the game is for Adam Grossworth. Here is your last clip. They ripped off the song from Airplane.
The whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's coming up roses.
War is hell.
Oh, Oh, poor George Zip. Is it Tyne Daly?
It is Tyne Daly. Yes. From Tyne Daly. So you are correct. And the production is...
Gypsy.
Gypsy, good for one. And that is the end of regulation game time. Tara, woo, final scores, please.
It was honestly a very close game the whole way through. Sarah finished with 13 points. I had 17, but Adam is our victor with 19.
Yay! Yes, that's all right.
Adam takes it. Go to work tomorrow.
Order maintained.
The order of the universe is maintained, yes. We do have our tiebreaker, which will we now repurpose for Shits and Giggles. I'm going to play a clip. I need someone to name the two actors that are singing here. Additional clue, both already been in Game Time. Are you ready? Scream out the two actors when you know it.
Mandy Patinkin and Patti LuPone.
You are... correct. That was the Patink and Patti LuPone.
The Vita, all right, again.
Oh, the Patink.
The Patink. All right. So Adam gets a steel meal for the value guess, but also takes the day.
Valued guest.
Oh my God, we forgot to do the production points thing. All right. Tara, can I please get the production points tally?
Sure. Sarah had 3. I had 6. Adam, of course, had 8.
All right. This is how it works. For every 2 points, you can exchange them for a steel mill, or for 5 points, you can get an extravaganza gong. Take a minute to think about it, and then tell me how you want to cash in your points. Sarah D. Bunting, I know you only have 3 points, so I guess you're going to get 1 steel mill for your trouble.
I will take a steel mill.
Tara Ariano, what are you going to do with your, how many points? 6?
6.
All right, so you can either take 3 steel mills or 1 extravaganza gong.
Extravaganza gong.
Yeah, that's the correct answer as far as I am concerned for entertainment purposes. And Adam Grossworth had how many?
8.
All right, so he's got 8. So you can do a mix. You can do 1 extravaganza gong and steel meal, all steel meals. What are you going to do?
Because I'm playing for others, I will be practical and take steel meals on behalf of valued guests.
4 steel meals added to the valued guest.
Dang.
Tally. Impressive. Nice. Way to go, Mr. Grossworth.
Yay.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra. Ah, great. We collected our bounty puck for the Star Wars live action series, The Mandalorian, before going around the dial with stops at High School the Musical, The Series, Encore, Back to Life, Point of View Bill Nye, and The Dark Crystal, and another dark show, His Dark Materials. Adam and Eleanor made a diagnosis for canonization of Grey's Anatomy's explosive episode as we know it. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Adam was the winner of this week's Musical Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
I wish he'd Mandalessian.
Sarah D. Bunting.
It might take a while. I'm molting.
And Adam Grossworth.
Collins.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Talk Great.
Pop that gum. Single one my more ass.
Time. Never feel so good, Uncle
Number
Sam
17, Uncle. The spread eagle.
Pop.
Six. Squish.
Hey, Extra Hot Great. I'm submitting for consideration for entry into the canon, Grey's Anatomy, Season 2, Episodes 16 and 17. It's the end of the world and as we know it. This is a double episode of the show, and if you've seen it before, you will undoubtedly remember it as the episode where Coach Taylor gets turned into a fine pink mist by a bomb that made its way to the Seattle Grace Hospital in the body cavity of a patient. R.I.P. Coach Taylor. A few things are going on in this double episode. First, Meredith Grey is not coping well at all with Derek Shepherd's, aka McDreamy's, decision to stay with his wife, the inimitable Addison Montgomery Shepherd, instead of picking, choosing, and loving Meredith. And not only did Meredith have a premonition of her own death, she also, more importantly, cannot even remember the last time she and Derek kissed. Second, Dr. Miranda Bailey, the intern's formidably competent yet compassionate chief resident, is supposed to be relaxing and preparing to give birth to her child, but she has to meet the interns in the ambulance bay to reprimand them for scaring off every resident who has tried to wrangle them while she was on bed rest. Oh, also, she's in labor, now, and her husband is in a car on the way to the hospital, but nobody knows what is taking him so long. We later learn that he's been in a horrific car accident, and he ends up on Derek's OR table. And of course, the A-plot. Christina Yang and Alex Karev are ready as an ambulance races towards the ER. The door opens and a shrieking woman emerges. Alex and Christina look up to see Christina Ricci, Hannah, the EMT, with her hand in an enormous wound of the patient, James, on the gurney in the back of the ambulance. After Alex shuts up the patient's tormented and incredibly annoying wife, Mindy, by screaming right back at her, she and James's brother let it spill that James cosplays World War II, and the reason that he's in the ER today is that he shot himself with a bazooka and, well, it never exploded. We've got a live one. The first part of the double episode ends on a cliffhanger. The doctors have to move the patient to a different OR, or pretty much everybody in the hospital is toast. We'll have to wait a week or until the Netflix autoplay moves us to the next episode to find out what happens, and a lot happens that I won't recount here. For a Grey's episode, this double episode has a pretty low body count. In a climactic montage set to Anna Nalick's Breathe, we see each plotline wrap up, in keeping with the show's famous use of weepy indie songs to make us feel all of our feelings at once. Bailey delivers a healthy baby, and Shepard does save Bailey's husband's life. And the only person who falls victim to the bomb is bomb squad cop Coach Taylor, who blows up walking away with the bomb that Meredith bravely extracted from James' body. After Derek's surgery, he's terrified, asking everyone downstairs in the waiting room, "Where is she?" And an ignorant Richard Weber does not see that Derek is not at all relieved when it's his wife who emerges to greet him. In the episode's final scene, Derek describes in true romantic detail, with little of what will become his trademark intolerable smugness, the last kiss he and Meredith shared. This won't be the end of the Meredith and McDreamy love story. Grey's Anatomy is a show that I watched for the very first time in the year of our Lord 2019, because I was way too busy watching 6 Feet Under and reading sad poetry to enjoy this with my high school and later college friends when the show was in its heyday. I'm caught up now, don't at me, and I agree with the widely held opinion that season 2 is the show's best, and this episode is an exemplar of that. This episode is not perfect. George's sexy dream sequence at the beginning is so hopelessly lame that you might have wanted to turn this off before the title card, but I hope you didn't. Having now watched the entire show up to this point, it was tough to go back and watch an episode that contains both George O'Malley and Izzy Stevens, two of the most annoying characters in the history of television. But still, there isn't a lot of Izzy in this episode. And George is the least insipid he's ever been in the moments where he helps Bailey deliver her baby in the midst of utter chaos and what seems like imminent tragedy. In that moment, George really had me misty. Too soon? This episode is genuinely suspenseful. Because I wasn't living under a rock when these episodes aired, I pretty much knew what happened, but I was still gripped by it. In typical Grey's fashion, not only do the doctors discover their patient has live ammunition in his body, but also, oops, they brought him to the OR that happens to be right above the hospital's main oxygen line. The operating team moving their patient from one OR to another is tense and quietly thrilling. As per usual, there are some heartbreaking moments in here. Everybody waits as long as they can to tell Bailey about her husband, because they don't want to freak her out while she's in labor. But Addison does eventually tell her. Bailey's happy moment turns terrifying and gut-wrenching, as she insists that she will not push until her husband is by her side and safe, but we know what terrible shape he's in on Derek's OR table. And the moment where Dr. Milton displays cowardice, or self-preservation, leaving a rookie EMT with her hand on live ammunition to keep a patient alive right after he scares the absolute shit out of her with talk of pink mist is really hard to watch, as it should be. This is also an episode where we get to see typical excellent work from Sandra Oh as Dr. Christina Yang. This includes the scene near the beginning of the episode, where Christina shows Meredith that she can be a, quote, totally supportive friend to Meredith by performatively bringing her hand to her chin and tilting her head as if it literally causes her physical pain to feign concern and listen to Meredith talk about conditioner when the interns are all late to work. It also features Kate Walsh's Addison, a beloved character we were supposed to hate, but who fans now still hope will make another return before the show's run is over. Grey's Anatomy is a melodramatic, soapish medical show, but many of the characters and their portrayals are engaging and complex. This episode is the first where we get a real glimpse of Meredith's inner darkness, as well as her role as the moral core of the show. She's not a typical protagonist here. She isn't just a bright-eyed young surgeon in training who chases after her dreamy boss. She doesn't just dream about her death, she has a little bit of a death wish. And being the only person in the OR who doesn't bother to shield herself from a potential explosion is the first major sign of this. Between the suspense, the tears, the reality-stretching medical malady, and the will-they-won't-they love story, I think this double episode comprises some of the best we've seen of Grey's Anatomy. I hope you'll agree and induct it into the canon.